The mass press really begins with the Industrial Revolution, which began in Europe and then spread rapidly in the United States in the mid-1800s, transforming the country from one based primarily around agriculture to large-scale industrial production. Industrialism, based on new methods of large-scale mass production, transformed the newspaper. Steam-powered presses replaced the mechanical press, and machine-made paper replaced expensive handmade paper. These innovations not only dropped the cost of production, but also enabled a huge ramping up of volume in the production of papers. Before the Industrial Revolution, the average newspaper cost 6 cents per copy and was sold through yearly subscriptions at $10 to $12, which was way more than a week's salary for even highly skilled workers. So newspapers at the time really were mostly for the affluent. But in 1833, printer Benjamin Day founded a newspaper called the New York Sun and set the price at just 1 penny per copy with no subscriptions. Day's paper grew rapidly in popularity and inspired a wave of cheap mass production papers that we now call the penny press, since they cost just 1 cent per copy. Other papers followed Day's penny press model, like James Gordon Bennett's The New York Herald and Horace Greeley of the New York Tribune. Many historians view the penny press as the birth of the mass press. Their circulations grew from just thousands to tens of thousands, and eventually hundreds of thousands of papers per day. The mass press created intense competition, and young children, often from poor immigrant families, were employed to sell papers on the street. Their dependency on child labor was one of the uglier realities of the drive to make profits and beat out the competition.
Hey, listen! Pulitzer and Hearst have to respect the rights of the working boys of New York! That's right!
Well, that went pretty good, so what else?
Tell them that they can't treat us like we don't exist.
Pulitzer and Hearst, they think we're nothing. Are we nothing?
No! We stick together like the trolley workers and they can't break us up.
Pulitzer and Hearst, they think they got us. Do they got us?
No! We're a union now, the Newsboys Union. We have to start acting like a union.
Even though we ain't got hats or badges, we're a union just by saying so. And the world will know.
Maybe you've seen the 1992 Disney movie, The Newsies, starring a young Christian Bale. Newsies tells a dramatized story of the 1899 Newsboys strike, in which thousands of newsboys organized a successful strike for higher pay. These newsboys worked extremely hard and often worked late into the night or were up before sunrise, and their strike helped force newspaper owners to increase their wages. Here you can see some real-life newsies of the time. Not so much singing and dancing. So why was there such a demand for newspapers? Well, remember, in the mid to late 1800s, there were no movies, no television, and no radio. There were books, and a variety theater called vaudeville was a popular form of entertainment, but newspapers were the main form of daily news and entertainment for millions of people, especially workers in this new industrialized society.
Get your paper, get your paper. I'm here to shout it, read all about it. Get your paper, read about the guy who murdered his rival. Getting the electric chair. Read about a country's fight for survival. Read about county.
This desire for daily entertainment, fueled by growing competition between publishers, would, in the mid to late 1800s, create a new style of sensational journalism, yellow journalism. The term yellow journalism stems from a popular cartoon that was carried in newspapers at the time with a character called the Yellow Kid. Yellow journalism focused on overly dramatic, sensational stories about crime, celebrities, disasters, scandals, and intrigue. The term yellow journalism is actually still used today. For example, if a news source is known for overly dramatic, crude, and sensational headlines, it might get criticized as practicing yellow journalism. Let's stop for a moment and take a closer look at this cartoon from Puck, a popular humor magazine of the era. Titled The Fin de Siècle, or End of the Century, Newspaper Proprietor, this image was published in 1894, at the height of the yellow press era. In the image, we see dozens of hurried newspaper reporters carrying scandalous-sounding stories. High spice sensation, private scandal, trashy gossip, cheap sensation, damaging rumors, thrilling exposé. And a term we hear quite often these days with the internet and social media, fake news. Yes, people were worried about fake news and misleading stories back then too. The reporters are tossing their stories into the printing press as fast as they can. Meanwhile, the newspaper owner is sitting pleased as his pile of profits spills through the door of his office closet. This cartoon is satirizing the influence of money and profit in driving the creation of sensational and scandalous news stories, part of a broader critique of the excesses and greed of capitalism that was common at the time. This was, after all, the Gilded Age, where there was a growing gap between the rich and the poor. The mass penny press really did make a handful of newspaper owners very rich. Many of these earliest media moguls, as they came to be called, got rich from selling scandal-filled newspapers to the public. In the 1890s, newspaper owners William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer engaged in a bitter, intense rivalry. Their respective papers, Hearst's New York Journal and Pulitzer's New York World, competed for readers by emphasizing sensationalism in their reporting, really epitomizing the style of yellow journalism. Their immense readership and financial wealth gave them significant power and influence over American politics. Hearst, in particular, is believed to have helped push the United States into war with Spain through exaggerated and sensationalized coverage of Spanish atrocities in Cuba, all covered extensively in his newspaper. Yet the other legacy of the yellow press that is often forgotten is that amid the drive to sell copies with dramatic stories, they also created the roots of investigative journalism. That is, news that investigates powerful institutions like companies or government officials to expose corruption, illegal actions, and abuse of power. From the 1890s to the 1920s, reform-minded journalists carried out major investigations of wealthy and powerful companies and industrialists. As they were out digging for the truth, they earned the nickname muckrakers. Many of these muckraker journalists were published in news magazines like Harper's or McClure's, popular progressive news magazines that sought to expose corruption. Their serialized publications were also turned into best-selling books. In 1906, muckraking journalist Upton Sinclair exposed unsafe and horrid working conditions in America's meatpacking industry. His reports were first published in the popular socialist newspaper, Appeal to Reason, and later compiled into his book, The Jungle, which became a bestseller among the public. Sinclair's investigative journalism raised public outcry, putting pressure on the U.S. government, which then passed laws for greater workplace safety and better working conditions in factories. In 1902, journalist Ida Tarbell, writing in McClure's magazine, exposed the ruthless and illegal business tactics of John D. Rockefeller, the richest man in America, who owned the Standard Oil Company. Her work was all the more impressive given the time, when few women worked as journalists or in other professions. Her investigations of the Standard Oil Company, which was nicknamed the Octopus for its heavy control over the oil industry and financial influence over Congress, led to such widespread public outcry that the US government declared the Standard Oil Company an illegal monopoly, and in 1911 broke it up into 34 different companies. Amid the yellow journalism of the penny press, there existed a growing demand for a more professional newspaper that reported information that was useful to merchants, professionals, and businessmen. So, in 1896, Adolph Oakes purchased the New York Times, a newspaper founded in the 1850s, and he rebuilt the paper around providing high-quality, substantial, and accurate reporting. To distance his paper's reporting from the yellow press, Oakes's New York Times intentionally avoided sensational headlines and favored documented, fact-based reporting. The Times wrote about foreign affairs, business deals, court reports, political developments, as well as things like theater and book reviews, targeting an upscale, well-educated readership. The New York Times, under Oakes's leadership, pioneered this new style of objective journalism, in which reporters focus on facts and analysis, relegating opinion to a special op-ed or opinion section. This objective model follows the inverted pyramid style of journalism, putting facts and information first and answering the who, what, when, where, how, or why in the beginning of the article, followed by less important details or analysis. Building a reputation for accuracy and prestige, the New York Times became known as the paper of record, meaning historians, archivists, lawyers, and others use the paper as a daily reference for important stories of a given day in history. Today, the Times is the most prestigious newspaper in the U.S. and one of the most influential news organizations in the world, covering U.S. and global news. It remains known as the paper of record. I myself start most days out by reading the New York Times, although online in digital form.
No matter what you're interested in, you're likely to find something about it in the newspaper.
By the mid-1900s, most newspapers had taken on the objective style of reporting, trying to appeal to the growing middle class. Other mass media, like radio and TV, would provide the drama and intrigue that yellow journalism once offered, leaving newspapers to focus more on news reporting. Journalism, as a profession, also experienced a kind of golden era. While journalists of the past often saw themselves as merely reporting the words and information from officials, journalists in the 1960s and 1970s increasingly took on major investigations and started to see their role as a check on the powerful. Perhaps the most famous story among investigative journalism is Watergate, the scandal that took down a U.S. president. When two young city reporters for the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, heard about a break-in at the Democratic Party national headquarters at the Watergate Hotel, they began what would turn into a 3-year investigation, which found that President Richard Nixon, a Republican, had paid a group of men to break into the Democratic Party national headquarters at night in order to try to steal their election strategy and dig up dirt on the Democrats so that Nixon could try to win re-election.
In a televised farewell last night, President Nixon acknowledged that because of the Watergate affair, he no longer has a strong enough base in Congress to continue with any effectiveness. He and his family are expected to leave by air for their home in California later this morning, and we expect to see their departure from the White House. I'm Barbara Walters with Jim Hartz.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. And we will have fuller details on this momentous story in just a moment, a story that many of us are still having trouble believing actually occurred.
Here is part of what the president said in his resignation speech last night.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
President Nixon was forced to resign in disgrace over the scandal, and to this day is the only U.S. president forced from office. The fearless journalism of Woodward and Bernstein was portrayed in the 1976 Academy Award-winning film, All the President's Men.
Woodward, Bernstein, you're both on the story now. Don't fuck it up.
Redford.
I'm Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Mr. Markham, are you here in connection with the Watergate burglary?
I'm not here.
Hoffman.
Hi, this is Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, and I was just wondering if you can remember...
All the President's Men. The story of the two young reporters who cracked the Watergate conspiracy.
Part of Watergate's legacy is that today, the word gate is often used to signal a scandal, from the serious to the silly, like Deflategate, Bridgegate, Gamergate, and many others. While Americans would turn to television for much of their national news in the second half of the 20th century, newspapers remained the bedrock of American journalism, especially at the local level. Yet, starting in the early 2000s, newspapers started losing major sources of their revenue in a process called the Craigslist effect. To understand what happened, let's first explain the revenue model for newspapers. You can think of a newspaper as a kind of bundle, a little bit of everything. A newspaper would have local, national, and international news, sure. But it would also have a whole bunch of other stuff. A sports section, travel guides, home decor tips, relationship advice, opinion columns, and so much more. Local newspapers functioned as a kind of informational hub for their communities. Birth, wedding, and death announcements, classifieds where people could pay a fee and list an apartment for rent or a job listing, putting up real estate for sale, you name it. Newspapers even offered a way to find a date, with classified sections like men seeking women or women seeking men. You could pay, by the line, to put in a little self-advertisement, hoping to win a date. Something like, adventurous 30-year-old, self-employed single male, looking for fun-loving woman, enjoys walks by the beach, hopeless romantic, must love cats. So in 1999, Craig Newmark created Craigslist, a website where people could, for free, post classifieds, apartments for rent, jobs, furniture, electronics, and yes, dating and romantic encounters too.
My next guest may have the biggest idea of all. It was a website that changed the lives of tens of millions of people. Some folks even say he could be bringing down the entire newspaper industry. I love guys like this. The founder of Craigslist, Craig Newmark. Welcome to Big Idea, sir.
How are you, man?
Hey, I'm great. Glad to be here.
But I want to understand the tipping point. You do your initial, what would you call it initially, what were you doing, what you were launching? What would you call it?
Initially, it was just a little bit of a mailing list for events involving technology and arts.
Okay. How does it, what I don't understand is how you, okay, you're this guy, and you're this kind of interesting, you know, computer guy, you do this thing, a little bit of a mailing list. For when did it start to become the everyman classified section for apartments, for jobs, for girlfriends? I mean, that's a big gap.
In our case, there's been no single tipping point. At the end of 97, when it was just me, I noticed that I was getting about a million page views per month. The folks at Microsoft Sidewalk, now defunct, asked me about running banner ads. I said no, by the way, and decided not to. But it's been slow, continuous growth.
You've got the newspaper industry. Their classified revenues are down 36%. Some could look at you and say, you're going to take down newspapers. That basically newspapers are going to, I want to put something on your shoulders. Newspapers are going to go away because of this crazy, you know, iconoclast, this guy who doesn't care about making money, and he's going to bring it to the people, and we're going to bring newspapers crashing down because their entire revenue stream is built on classifieds.
Craigslist was just one of many new, totally free websites and web platforms that would take away the revenue sources for newspapers. So the Craigslist effect refers to how the internet, with its extremely low or free cost of production, would kind of unbundle the newspaper and really take away many of its key sources of ad revenue. The second wave of revenue loss came with the emergence of social media platforms like Facebook. Many local businesses depended on newspapers for their advertisements, but today, businesses of any size can easily and more cheaply put ads on social media platforms like Facebook or on websites through Google's AdSense. To survive in the digital age, many newspapers have created paywalls for their online news content, which enable people to read either 5 or 10 free articles per month, but then require a paid subscription. While this has helped some papers create a new digital revenue model, many papers just can't convince enough people to actually pay for a subscription. All in all, by the 2010s, local newspapers were losing money, and many were going out of business. This continues to be a really worrisome trend, as local newspapers create upwards of 50% of all original news reporting in the United States. We're also seeing a new worrisome trend, news deserts. These are U.S. counties with just one or no local newspaper. There are many innovative and exciting new forms of journalism and news reporting online, like utilizing amateur shot video for rapid on-the-ground coverage, or interactive forms of data-rich journalism through things like infographics. These all help tell complicated stories for the public. And many national and international news sources are actually thriving. Also, given the large amount of false and often misleading information that thrives on social media, many prestigious news organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post are actually doing quite well, with millions of digital subscribers willing to pay for fact-based, high-quality journalism. Yet, as any local reporter will tell you, local journalism is in a kind of crisis, and there's no clear solution in sight. Will people be willing to pay for local digital news stories? Ultimately, without local newspapers and reporters to cover local business and government, we could be facing a new era of high levels of corruption and abuses of power gone unreported. And we could also see a continued decline in local civic engagement.